know, he was a very humble man, but he was very powerful at the same time, you know, very committed to what he was doing. And you could see that aura he had, you know, you could physically see it.
We would play all night and play long solos, and in between the intermissions or something, he would go someplace and stand in the corner and practice, because he had that in his mind and he wanted to get it out.
Train was obsessed with music. You know, I even mentioned one day about, hey, Train, did you see what Willie Mays did? He said, who is Willie Mays, Jim? Because he wasn't interested in baseball or any of that business. He was all music.
Musicians have been as driven by their art as John Coltrane. He was never without his saxophone, practicing everywhere and anywhere, constantly searching for the key that would take his music to the next level. His life was suffused with an obsessive yearning for that balance between music and the spirit. I'm Nancy Wilson on this edition of Jazz Profiles, part one of our tribute to Train, saxophonist John Coltrane. John Coltrane transformed the very sound of the tenor saxophone. Just as the alto saxophone was never the same after Charlie Parker, and the electric guitar was reinvented by Jimi Hendrix, no one played tenor saxophone the same way after John Coltrane. His rapid-fire runs, cascading layers of notes, and often vocal tone, changed the very way we hear the horn. John Coltrane died in 1967, just 40 years old. More than three decades later, the wake he left in the stormy seas of jazz has yet to fill in.
Coltrane is still a revered figure among musicians, both young and old.
Coltrane biographer Lewis Porter, author of John Coltrane, His Life and Music.
There are a number of reasons for that. One is, of course, the sheer power of his music and the virtuosity, the brilliance, the originality.
Few people forget the first time they heard Train. Writer Amiri Baraka was covering the jazz scene as Leroy Jones in the 1950s and 60s.
You know, I could feel that rush of the rhythm, and he would be running it. You know, I mean, the rhythm would be scalding.
Thank you. Coltrane didn't emerge full-blown, breaking down the boundaries of rhythm and harmony. He had to work hard, practice hard, and dedicate his very existence to music.
It's kind of interesting the way Coltrane developed, because on his very first recordings, which were just made for fun when he was 19, he's still struggling.
Louis Porter.
And in that way, Coltrane's very different from a lot of the other famous jazz musicians. Charlie Parker, at the age of 20 on his first recordings, he sounds terrific. And of course, you have, you know, Lee Morgan when he was 18 and Dizzy Gillespie when he was 20. So Coltrane's different that way.
Train was different in many ways. Born on September 23rd, 1926, in Hamlet, North Carolina, John William Coltrane grew up in a working-class family. His grandfathers were ministers, and Train got music from the church and his father at home.
He was a tailor by profession, but he played apparently a few instruments, a little bit of violin, a little bit of ukulele, maybe a little bit of clarinet.
The family moved to High Point, North Carolina, where his father died when John Coltrane was 12 years old. In High Point, Coltrane began playing clarinet. Louis Porter says the young musician was listening to big band music as a teenager in the 30s and 40s.
Because High Point was big enough, big bands would come either to High Point or close by on tour. Bands like Jimmy Lunsford, Ella Fitzgerald, when she was leading her own band after Chick Webb died. Some of these groups would come by, and even Count Basie, and they would have a chance to see them live.
It wasn't long before Coltrane switched to alto saxophone. His family moved north to Philadelphia, where he became immersed in a jumping music scene.
We had a lot of people there, Red Rodney and Benny Golson and Jerry Mulligan was there.
Saxophonist Jimmy Heath, one of Coltrane's best friends in Philadelphia.
My brother Percy and myself were there, of course. Bill Barron was the saxophone player around before Kenny, his younger brother. Ray Bryant was there.
Tossed into this music cauldron, Coltrane worked hard, studying with Dennis Sandoli, a Philadelphia teaching legend. It was a musical environment that put a premium on technical proficiency and depth of knowledge. And it wasn't just jazz. Coltrane immersed himself in classical music.
He and I used to go to the Philadelphia Museum and put on the headsets and listen to Western classical music, of course. Oh, we were listening to Stravinsky and, you know, and some of the Romantics.
Although he studied with academic composers like Leo Ornstein, Coltrane's destiny wasn't with classical music. He was devouring the new jazz of the time, especially the bebop of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Tenor saxophonist Benny Golson was another of Coltrane's friends. Together, they saw Bird and Diz for the first time in 1945 at Philadelphia's Academy of Music. Charlie Parker made a deep impression.
And this fella bent over. I thought he was going to pop out of the suit. And he made a four-bar pickup playing double time. And John tried to climb up my body. And we almost fell over the balcony. We couldn't believe it. We're not talking about a great performance. We're talking about a performance the likes of we had never, ever heard before in our young lives. And after the show, of course, we went back and got autographs. But we followed Mr. Parker up the street. And John said to him, "Can I carry your horn, Mr. Parker?" And so Mr. Parker let him carry the horn.
Jimmy Heath put together a big band inspired by the music of Bird and Diz, with John Coltrane playing alto. For a benefit concert, Heath convinced Charlie Parker to play with them.
Someone took a picture of that. Between Charlie Parker and myself sits John Coltrane with a cigarette in his hand, almost burning his hand in amazement at what Charlie Parker was doing, as we all were.
Enraptured by Charlie Parker, as well as saxophonists Lester Young and Johnny Hodges, Train became obsessed with reaching perfection on his horn. Everyone who encountered the saxophonist has a story about his practice habits. Pianist McCoy Tyner was a member of Coltrane's classic 1960s quartet.
During the break, you know, intermission, he would go in the back in the dressing room, or if they had a basement, he'd go down there and practice.
Jimmy Heath.
He would practice in hotels, and people would call on the desk and say, "Hey, stop that guy from playing that saxophone up there." And then Train would take it out of his mouth and just finger it for another half hour, hour.
Constantly, day and night.
Coltrane's widow, Alice Coltrane.
He would come home from work. He'd drive in from New York, reach home, like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. He's in the garage practicing.
Coltrane's incessant practicing hadn't paid off yet when he entered the Navy in 1945. He played in a naval band called the Melody Masters, and that resulted in his first known recording in 1946. Coltrane biographer Lewis Porter.
And it was just one day in Hawaii, just before he was leaving the Navy, he and some friends said, "Let's get together and jam." So it's not even a formal band. It's very loose, but they had played together before, even though this was kind of off the cuff. They knew the same tunes, and they were all into Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis.
John Coltrane playing Hot House from 1946, a rare recording from the album The Last Giant. You're listening to First Impressions, part one of our portrait of saxophonist John Coltrane on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson.
Down and cry.
When John Coltrane returned to Philadelphia from the service, he picked up gigs with a swing band led by King Colax, and then played the blues with Eddie Cleanhead Vincent. It was with Vincent in 1947 that Coltrane began making the switch from alto to tenor saxophone. Lewis Porter.
Eddie Cleanhead Vincent had a standard instrumentation. He was an alto player. He always had a tenor player in the group that accompanied him. He had a group of about six musicians. So in order for Coltrane to be in that gig, he had to start specializing on the tenor saxophone. And he loved the tenor saxophone and said once in an interview that when he was listening to the alto, that pretty much Charlie Parker was it. I mean, he was so dominating that there wasn't really anybody else you were going to listen in the mid-40s. So switching to the tenor was very critical for him.
One expectation of blues tenor players was that they walked down the bar in a club, honking on their horn. Throughout his career, John Coltrane was noted for his dignified demeanor. So it always comes as a surprise to learn that he could be a showman and play the blues as down and dirty as the best of them. Jimmy Heath.
The tenor player's always supposed to walk the bar. And when you walk the bar, you're doing a little honking and screaming on the saxophone, and people would put money in the bell of your horn. But Train was playing all that stuff, and I heard, and this is a rumor, that somebody poured some beer in his horn in the bell. I don't know how true that is, but I know he wasn't playing the stuff that the bar walkers would play. They were just show business people.
Coltrane never disavowed this aspect of his career, and years later, the blues remained a vital part of his sound. In September of 1949, the saxophonist got a chance to play with one of his earliest idols. Trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie tapped Train, along with Jimmy Heath, to become alto players in his orchestra. Jimmy Heath.
We were fascinated every night at the way Dizzy could create different melodies in his improvisation every night, because he would play something different all the time. And this fascinated all of us, because Dizzy was a true improviser, and Coltrane became a true improviser.
Coltrane cut his first commercial sides with Dizzy Gillespie.
I had a wife and Dude Ranch, and both were doing fine. I love those 40 acres, for she was mine, all mine. Last night, we came to dinner. My wife was making stew. You made me lose my dumpling, for she ran off with you.
You stole my wife, you horsey.
The wife that I used to adore.
You stole my wife, you horsey.
But don't bring her back anymore.
John Coltrane playing with the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra on You Stole My Wife, You Horse Thief from 1950. Although Coltrane didn't get to solo much on alto with Dizzy, Jimmy Heath says he already had an inherent style.
Coltrane had perfect rhythm. His harmonic knowledge was limited, as all of us at that time, but his expressions on the alto were similar to that of Charlie Parker, in that he had the same eruptive quality, like a volcano, the bubbling, and then the exploding, you know, similar to, if you were saying, like Charlie Parker. He had that already built in.
By the late 1940s, the touring big bands were on their way out, pressured by changing tastes and finances. Dizzy broke up his orchestra, but he formed a smaller group, and one of the musicians he kept on was John Coltrane, now taking solos on tenor saxophone.
Well, boogie, woogie, re-bop-it-be-bop-it-toogie.
We Love to Boogie by Dizzy Gillespie, recorded in 1951 with John Coltrane on tenor. Dizzy Gillespie gave Train his first national exposure, and he seemed to be a talent on the rise. But he soon hit the wall that had plagued jazz musicians for years. He was influenced not only by the music of Charlie Parker, but by his drug of choice, heroin. Coltrane became addicted in 1948. His friend, Jimmy Heath, was a junkie as well.
On one occasion, when I was given a notice, was up in Toronto, Canada, and we were playing on a show with a guy named Bill Farrell who sang You've Changed. Anyway, Train had started to drink, trying to get off his drug thing, and we went on the stage and he was asleep in the toilet. And Dizzy got mad about that. I said, where's Coltrane? I said, I don't know.
It wasn't long before Gillespie fired Coltrane. For the next few years, Train bounced from gig to gig. He recorded with a singer named Gay Cross, played and recorded with saxophonist Earl Bostic, and spent 2 years with an early influence, alto player Johnny Hodges. John Coltrane, playing with Johnny Hodges around 1954, on Through for the Night. Although he was working, his career progress was stalled. But the power of John Coltrane was still brewing beneath the surface. In the late 50s, that power would explode as Coltrane apprenticed with two living legends and experienced a spiritual revelation. That and more just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to First Impressions, part one of a portrait of saxophonist John Coltrane on Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio. By the early 1950s, saxophonist John Coltrane had played everything from R&B to bebop. He'd endured the ritual of walking the bar and the thrill of playing on stage with his heroes, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Train continued to be plagued by drug and alcohol addiction, and he'd yet to make a significant recording. But that was all about to change. In September of 1955, Coltrane got the call from trumpeter Miles Davis to join his quintet. Jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
Miles heard something in Coltrane that made him hire this guy. And one of the things I think that appealed to Miles was the contrast between his own sound and his lyricism and the more kind of abrasive sound that Coltrane had. And that was a contrast. And Miles was always aware of the effectiveness of contrast.
Miles Davis, playing Stablemates with John Coltrane from a 1956 session, Coltrane's first with the iconoclastic trumpeter. Coltrane's development was finally being documented as the Miles Davis Group cut albums like Cookin', Relaxin', Workin', and Steamin'. Train began finding his own voice. Coltrane biographer Lewis Porter.
Coltrane favored a sound that was very focused, very intense. You know, it has kind of a scream in it all the time. It has an incredible kind of poignant beauty to it.
In a 1966 interview, conducted in a car, parked at a noisy New Jersey supermarket, John Coltrane told writer Frank Kofsky about some of the early reactions to his sound.
Now, when he first heard me with Miles here, he did not like it. But when we went to Europe the first time, it was a shock to them there, you know, like it fooled me and everything in Paris.
John Coltrane with Miles Davis playing Blues by Five. At the same time he joined the trumpeter, he married Juanita Austin on October 3, 1955. Juanita became best known by her Muslim name, Naima, when Coltrane titled one of his best love songs after her. Once again, Coltrane's career seemed poised for takeoff when his heroin addiction grounded him. Lewis Porter.
Coltrane's heroin addiction was really making him unreliable in the band. He would show up late, he would fall asleep on the bandstand, he would show up dressed in with his clothes all wrinkled, you know, dressed improperly. Miles said he used to pick his nose on the bandstand.
Miles reluctantly let Coltrane go in April of 1957. It was the first of several events that would propel Coltrane on a new path. Returning to Philadelphia, Train had what was described as a religious revelation.
He says in the liner notes to Love Supreme, he says, I experienced a spiritual awakening in the year 1957.
This epiphany gave Coltrane the impetus to finally kick heroin, which he did that same year. Then came Monk. Pianist Thelonious Monk was a legend in jazz, and someone Train had followed along with Bird and Diz. Monk had already heard Coltrane playing with Miles and recorded Monk's Mood with him in April of 1957. Amiri Baraka remembers the dynamic of a driven Coltrane meeting an eccentric Monk.
You say you go up to Monk's house and get him out to bed. Monk wouldn't say nothing. He'd just go in there and start playing the tunes. He wouldn't say nothing. He just started playing the tunes. And Mr. Train, he'd say, I looked at him, and then I started trying to play them tunes. And he'd say, I go up there the next day. He wouldn't say nothing. He'd just play the tune. And I would look at him, and then I would start playing the tune.
By the time they played a legendary 1957 stand at the Five Spot, a New York club, Train had gotten a handle on Monk's idiosyncratic approach.
Monk was in his world, because when Train got that stuff and he could hear Train woo like that, he would leap up from the piano and start dancing through Train's whole solo. then you were in for something, because once that happened, you know, Train was straight out. He was gone.
Thelonious Monk playing I Mean You with John Coltrane on tenor saxophone, recorded at the Five Spot in 1957. Monk seemed to give Coltrane permission to explore with both long solos and new techniques. Louis Porter.
Coltrane said that Monk was perhaps the key person who encouraged him to experiment with multiphonics, with playing more than one note at a time. And he said it was interesting that Monk wasn't even a saxophonist, but he just knew that was something that Coltrane should explore, that he would be good at.
One of Coltrane's earliest recordings using multiphonics was Harmonique on his 1960 album, Coltrane Jazz. John Coltrane was a highly regarded figure in jazz now and in demand for session dates. He recorded with Paul Chambers, Hank Mobley, and in 1956 with another former Miles Davis sax man, Sonny Rollins. Coltrane had replaced Rollins in the Miles Davis group, but they'd occasionally play together on stage with the trumpeter and were frequently compared. Sonny Rollins.
Coltrane and I played together with Miles' band. And so I guess we had certain battles over the years, you know. And of course, everybody would cast us as rivals.
Coltrane had nothing but admiration for Rollins and even wrote a song for him, Light Sunny. John Coltrane from a 1960 interview in Stockholm.
Well, Sonny Rollins is, I think he's outstanding to the man today. You know, he's great.
Thank you. Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane in a meeting of tenor titans called Tenor Madness. Prompted by a recording contract from Prestige Records, Coltrane put together his own sextet. It was already evident that he had a conception of music that extended beyond being just a hot saxophone player. Louis Porter.
Even on the first Coltrane recordings under his own name, one was called Coltrane on Prestige in May of 57, and the other, of course, is Blue Train in September 57 on Blue Note. His compositions stand out. It's clear that he's a very original composer, that his compositions have a satisfying feel to them. They feel like they have a personality. They're not just, oh, here's another bebop tune or something like that. They have unusual lengths and unusual structures to them.
From 1957, John Coltrane with the title track from Blue Train, with trumpeter Lee Morgan, trombonist Curtis Fuller, pianist Kenny Drew, bassist Paul Chambers, and on drums, Philly Joe Jones. You're listening to First Impressions, part one of our portrait of saxophonist John Coltrane on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1957, Miles Davis called a now clean and sober John Coltrane back into the fold. Together, they made some of the most momentous and influential music in jazz. Philly Joe Jones, Paul Chambers, and pianist Bill Evans backed the front line of Miles, Coltrane, and altoist Cannonball Adderley. The music smoldered as the three horns alternately chased and intertwined around each other. Cannonball Adderley, interviewed in 1972.
Train had an extremely light, fluid sound. And my alto sound has always been influenced by the tenor. So it was heavy, and sometimes it was difficult to tell when one instrument stopped and another one started.
Exactly, see,
because
exactly.
It sounded like a continual phrase.
As he often did, Miles Davis was changing his music, creating a simpler sound that came to be known as modal jazz. Louis Porter.
Just at the time that Coltrane, in his own compositions, was getting interested in how complicated and how quickly can you move from one key to the next in a jazz composition, Miles was getting interested in, can you just stay in one key and forget about changing keys? It was almost the opposite approach.
Miles Davis's classic, So What, from Kind of Blue, with John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. Kind of Blue is one of the best-selling and most influential jazz albums ever. The modal format was the key that John Coltrane was waiting for. Its open structures gave him the freedom to expound at length. From a 1960 interview in Stockholm, John Coltrane.
I've been so free here, you know, that almost anything I want to try, I'm welcome to do it. It has led me into most of the things that I'm doing now. Yeah.
Drummer Jimmy Cobb, who frequently sat in for Philly Joe Jones, remembers that Miles wasn't always patient with Coltrane on the bandstand.
He would play long solos. I mean, like, he would play so long. Sometimes Miles, he would say things to him like, he said, why don't you play 26 choruses instead of 27? And Train would say something like, well, man, you know, I'm hung up in this stuff and I don't know where to end it. Miles would just take the horn out your mouth.
The long solos were part of John Coltrane's process in developing one of the most distinctive tenor sounds in jazz, Louis Porter.
What starts happening as you get later in the 1950s, you start hearing him relying entirely on his original melodic ideas. You don't hear anymore the stuff that you can relate to other people. You don't hear something that you can say, oh, that's a Dexter Gordon lick or that's a Charlie Parker lick. All you hear are Coltrane licks. They're all original, they're distinctive, and they have their own character.
Coltrane had become known for his sheets of sound, a term coined by critic Ira Gittler. Because of his long and often intense solos, with phrases rushing over each other like an avalanche, Coltrane acquired a tag as an angry player. John Coltrane in 1960.
It sounds angry because I'm trying so many things at one time, you see. Like, I haven't sorted them out. I have a whole bag of things that I'm trying to work through and get the one essential, you know.
John Coltrane playing The Believer, a song written by his future pianist, McCoy Tyner. By 1959, John Coltrane had already planned his exit from the Miles Davis group. Tenor saxophonist Wayne Shorter was his replacement, and he remembers Train's dissatisfaction.
He was on the new music trail because one of the last things Coltrane told me is that he was tired of playing Put Your Little Foot Right Out and Bye Bye Blackbird and Billy Boy with the kind of harmonic structure that he was laying over top and underneath and around it. He said, I feel like I'm playing wrong. He said, it doesn't really fit. It's a forced thing.
Within a few months of recording Kind of Blue, John Coltrane made his own major statement, Giant Steps, with drummer Art Taylor, pianist Tommy Flanagan, and Paul Chambers on bass. Giant Steps yielded no fewer than four jazz standards, Naima, Mr. PC, Countdown, and the title track, Giant Steps. More than any Coltrane album, Giant Steps encapsulated the extremes of this musician. The title piece is a complex, ambitious work that continues to challenge musicians decades later. Coltrane biographer Louis Porter.
At the time that Coltrane wrote Giant Steps, he was working on a series of compositions, and the idea is to go through a number of keys very, very quickly. Most pieces of music change keys every now and then, or certainly if there's a bridge or a second section or second theme, they change keys right there. But it's very rare for them to change keys every second or every couple of seconds, and that's what happens in Giant Steps. Well, that means when you're improvising, you have to be constantly thinking, what key am I in, what key am I in, what key am I in?
Giant Steps remains a challenging and high-energy composition, but one of Coltrane's most recorded and loved tunes is a ballad called Naima, named for his first wife.
And it's a gorgeous piece, and it shows off the fact that Coltrane had two very different sides in his music. On the one side, he can be furious and fast and, you know, blinding speed and blinding intensity. But on the other hand, when it came time to play something slow and stately and pretty, he didn't feel he had to prove anything.
John Coltrane's Naima, from the 1959 album Giant Steps. It was a prophetic title, elevating John Coltrane into the upper reaches of jazz and setting the stage for a group that many consider one of the best in modern music, the John Coltrane Quartet. As Coltrane stood poised for the 60s, he was revealed as a musician who bared his soul on every solo. Writer Amiri Baraka.
When Train plays a tune, sad tune, you get sad right away. I mean, some of those tunes, like After the Rain, for instance, or Lonnie's Lament, you know, you have that deep, 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 deep melancholy.
By the end of the 1950s, John Coltrane wasn't just a musician. He was engaged in a spiritual quest that took him beyond his saxophone.
It would often sound like he'd already transcended the instrument, because sometimes it didn't sound like horn. It didn't sound like an instrument that man has created.
John Coltrane's second wife, pianist Alice Coltrane.
We started to hear a feeling. We started to hear like an inner conversation or inner sort of output of his thoughts, his emotions, his feelings, somehow limited to an instrument. But yet that instrument was the sounding board from which he could express himself.
Thank you. First Impressions, part one of our tribute to John Coltrane, was written, produced, and mixed by John DiLiberto. Jazz Profile's executive producer is Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. The senior producer is Margaret Howes. Our website coordinator is John Murph. Administrative assistant, Linda Broen. Special thanks to Kimberly Haas. Additional thanks to the Pacifica Radio Foundation Archives, Elizabeth Perez Luna, Thurston Briscoe of WBGO in Newark, Jim Luce, Russell Westner, the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and NPR's Making the Music. Further thanks to Terry Hente of Fantasy Records. To email us, and for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, where jazz lives.
Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.